You're listening to The After Show, the bonus episode series for On Tour with Brian Ray. This is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, and I'm your host, Mandy Wimmer. In The After Show, we dive a little deeper into Brian's thoughts about certain parts of the interviews, as well as expound a bit more on his own experiences on tour. We get into some crazy stories in this after show. We hear Brian's thoughts on Prince getting booed off stage when they were both opening for the Rolling Stones, Prince's insane work ethic and how that may have contributed to his untimely death, and the impact his songs have had on artists and audiences alike, particularly Purple Rain. Brian shares his own boot camp production story, and we wrap with his final moments with Etta James shortly before she passed. Here's my conversation with Brian Ray. Brian, what up?
What up? So we meet again.
Hello. Oh, awesome interview this week. Leroy, what a gem of a person, and what a freaking talented person.
Yeah, so talented, so dedicated. I mean, has literally spent his whole life focused on making things look otherworldly and beautiful.
I don't think that the production and lighting teams and the crew and everyone really get enough credit for pulling all of this off. Clearly nothing can be done without any cog in the wheel, yeah. You know, so to say. And the sets and the lighting design, I mean, Leroy has been the production designer for some of the biggest names in music, award shows, everything. Yeah. I mean, I really encourage everyone who's listening to actually go to his website. I think it's leroybennett.com and look at everything he's been involved in. I mean, you have a couple hours, make some coffee. I mean, it's impressive.
Yeah, some very important acts, you know, none the least of which is... Not in the least of whom would be Prince and Paul McCartney and Lady Gaga. There's just so many more, though.
Oh, my God, a million more. So, you know, just to get right into it, because we have a lot to talk about with Leroy. So one thing that I was curious about, and I'm not sure if the audience may have been as well, is that you guys both said that you were part of the Cavallo Ruffalo scene. However, neither of you really kind of went into what that was. And so personally, I don't know what that is. So
right.
Can you expound on that a little bit?
Bob Cavallo and Joe Ruffalo were a management team in the heyday of sort of California R&B and rock. And they handled some of the coolest artists around. They handled Earth, Wind & Fire for their sort of white hot sort of hot new period. They handled a band that I loved named Little Feat. Who was around forever and ever and ever. They handled John Sebastian of the Lovin' Spoonful and many more things in his career. And they handled Valerie Carter, who was an amazing vocalist. And they handled this new ingenue, a guy that no one had heard of before, named Prince. And they would soon, of course, you know, everyone would know of Prince within a year.
And did you say the band that you were in with them was which one?
Yes. So I was with a guy named Reggie Knighton in a band called the Reggie Knighton Band. And we were managed by Cavallo Ruffalo. So they were just a really cool management, energetic management team. And their outpost was in Beverly Hills on Brighton Way. And I remember going to the office and, you know, seeing all these artists come in and go. And it was an exciting time.
So did you know of Prince during that period or no?
I didn't know Prince. I had a sighting. I knew what he looked like now. And this is about 1977, 78. And I'm at a 7-Eleven in the Valley. And here comes this guy wearing a black leather trench coat. And it's him. It's Prince.
Right.
And he was working with this woman who also worked with the management named Jamie. And, you know, I just kind of nodded. He kind of nodded back. That's it. I mean, that's the most contact I've ever had personally with Prince.
Well, I mean, what a phenomenon Prince was. I find it really interesting. Obviously, going behind the scenes, into the rehearsals, into the lives of some of these huge artists, I find very interesting, which is, you know, what we're doing on this show. And really to get an insider look into the world of Prince from his best friend, Leroy, who was, I mean, they were obviously best friends, very close friends for 15 years or more, someone who worked with him and was also a close friend of him offstage. The stories that Leroy shares in here in this interview were insane. And I think of one of the most interesting things that Leroy shares is in his very first few days with Prince, the first 5 days, he said, was just a boot camp from hell. And, you know, he Prince was asking him to do all of these different things, and he didn't even know what he was asking him to do because Prince wasn't, you know, a producer. He wasn't a lighting designer. He didn't really know how hard the things were, and he was asking him to do things that were basically impossible. But Leroy would do it, and basically what Prince just wanted to see is that he didn't quit. And it wasn't the really interesting thing, and I promise I'll let you talk, but the really interesting thing about this, I thought, that Leroy said was he would not ask someone to do something that he wouldn't do himself. So it wasn't like, I'm just going to put you through hell to put you through hell. I want to know that you are as dedicated to my performances as I am.
Yeah.
And that's, and he would do the same thing himself. He would put himself through the same paces. I mean, do you know of anyone? Have you ever worked with anyone that was like that? And oh, one more thing. I promised to let you talk, but I lied, obviously. The other piece, which
do
I know.
Do go on. Yeah, please continue.
I'm wrapping this up, but this is important. They would not ever do after parties, after shows. After a show, they would immediately go to their hotel, and every critical person would be there rewatching the show, finding pieces that messed up and perfecting it. Could you imagine?
No, I've never been in an organization quite that exacting before. But I think that generally a lot of people out there don't really know how shows, tours, records come together. They just see the finished product and go, thank you very much. Oh, my God, this is great.
Right.
And they just think it's all like toadstools and rainbows.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really hard work.
Right.
And, you know, what I'm hoping to do with you with this show that I'm enjoying so much is to sort of shed some light onto a process that is mysterious to people.
Right.
And part of that is, you know, to talk about an artist that's very, very demanding and exacting as Prince was. And there are many others, names I won't name because I wasn't in their band. It wouldn't be fair for me, but I've heard stories.
I'm sure.
I guess the worst it ever got for me, or the most demanding it ever was for me in terms of long rehearsals, was my first touring in France with Abe Laboriel Jr. actually on drums for a woman named Mylène Farmer. And her shows were spectacular and way over the top, like production values. Like she'd enter like through a giant statue and come down on a cable you couldn't
Wow.
see with her arms out, like she was like a deity, and come down to a conveyor belt that would then take her out to the
Wow.
middle of the audience, like really intense. So to perform these entrances, like these very intense entrances that had many elements, all of which had to work together at the perfect timing.
Right.
The band leader and the tour director would have the band play the intro song over and over and over for about 3 days straight. I mean, like 4 hours.
It couldn't be a track. You
hours.
Had to be doing it live.
I'm just saying.
Oh, dear.
We have the technology, but she needed to feel like, I'm not dissing her. It was really more about the production manager.
Right, right.
And it was pretty rough. But, you know, it all led to one of the most impactful, amazing, exciting introductions you've ever seen. But they probably could have used a tape.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That sounds painful.
It was a little bit. You can ask Abe about it when we yeah. when we get to Abe Laboriel Jr.
So, Abe, tell me about
tell
this
me
great
about
time
these.
In your life I'm going to bring back up
yeah.
again. So the other thing that I think was interesting, kind of along these same lines, is that in the vein that Prince would not ask you to do anything that he wouldn't do, Leroy says it was really hard on him, very, very hard on him, but he would not have wanted to be a member of the band because Prince could play anything better than anybody. And he did, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you
how do you impress Prince? know, I mean, he can do everything, right? So it's like, are you ever good enough? You know, just, I mean, I can imagine being on stage. I mean, even with you, you've mentioned about being next to Paul McCartney. I mean, you're an insanely amazing guitar player and Paul McCartney's one of the best. It's like, you're always like, oh my God. I mean, you have to be comparing all the time.
It is similar in that way. Like Paul is one of those rare artists that can do everything.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then he's also a ridiculous songwriter, arranger, producer, visual concept.
Totally.
Genius, you know, but he plays guitar, piano, bass, you know, acoustic, mando, you know, he plays everything. So, and he plays all of it really well.
Right.
So it's not like he's going to say, well, how would you do that? He would just say, Brian, could you play that in the other position? You know, like, you know, and so like he knows what he's talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't like, you can't fake it with someone like that.
Right.
And I can imagine, you know, with Prince and his, as you called it, exacting personality, you know, then on top of that, you know, where he just really didn't let anything slide. I can imagine that if you were a band member, you'd be like living in fear.
Well, it's true. And Prince really cut his teeth on artists like James Brown, who was famously very, very tough on his band. And he had hand signals that he would throw on stage, one hand flashing out, like spreading his fingers. That's five.
Yeah.
Another hand, that's 10.
Right.
Both, that's $20 you're going to have to pay.
And that's what Leroy was saying, is that's exactly what Prince would do. He would do hand signals. So if you miss them, then it's $50.
Yeah.
I mean, he was straight James Brown. And that's so interesting. I got to see Prince a couple times, thank God, because one of my favorite performers. But I saw him after in Chicago after George Lucas's wedding at City Winery. And it was one of those shows that was, he was supposed to go on at 11 or midnight. He goes on at 2. In the morning or something like that. I mean, I think we left around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. It was insane. But Leroy was talking about how he plays every instrument, and I got to actually see that. He was literally, it was a very small stage, and he was just going around to every member of the band. I mean, he had all the horns, you know, he had the backup singers. He had, I mean, everyone that was part of his band at George Lucas's wedding was packed on this tiny little stage, and he would just go grab instruments literally from everybody and start playing them and then take the spot of the backup singer, and then he'd faint, and then he'd, I mean, it was honestly probably the best show I've ever seen in my life. But the talent that this person, the raw talent of this person that's standing right in front of you and in such a small venue, I mean, I'll never forget it.
Yeah, white hot meteor, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, it's sad that he's not still with us. And then you think to yourself, well, some people are meant to shine hot and bright for a finite amount of time, and others, you know, stay relevant well into their older age, actors as well, you know, artists, writers, but performing at that level.
Right.
You know, he was doing the knee drops and the thing and the, you know, all the crazy stuff. And he did damage his knees and hips, you know, doing all that stuff.
Right.
Even Tom Petty had damaged his knees, you know, from doing knee drops back in the new wave and, you know, alt rock days of his beginning. So it is a demanding line of work. And he was just, you know, white hot. What can you say? Crazy talented.
So while we're on that topic, one thing Leroy mentioned was that Prince actually predicted somewhat his own death. He was fascinated with some of these artists that died young and beautiful, is what Leroy said it. And be so incredibly sad to lose him as young as we did. But Leroy said that his plan was to die in his late 30s, and he died, I think, in his 50s. So thank God for that.
Yeah, yeah. And he had a very long career. It wasn't over in a split second like some others, like, you know, say, you know, Jimi Hendrix, that was really white hot.
Right, right.
But, you know, he's just someone who gave so much, and we're so grateful for all that he gave, you know, for sure.
So your first major experience with Prince, though, you were also performing, so I'm not sure if you actually saw him live, but was Rolling Stones tour. You and Etta James were opening for the Stones, as was Prince. That was a big topic of conversation in this interview, how Prince got booed off stage for wearing a thong and thigh-high boots. And what was going through your mind at that point, knowing that that was happening? Did you recognize the talent of Prince and thought that this was crazy, or did you see any of his performances?
Now, I don't recall if we followed with Etta James, if we followed Prince's set or if he followed us. But in any case, I was either getting off stage and, you know, drying off and changing clothes, or getting ready to go on stage. So I missed his performance, but I heard about it immediately afterwards. And yes, he was wearing a leather thong and like women's high-heeled boots. And well, I mean, with a very fine little heel is when I say women's. I mean, it was not like, you know, dude boots.
Not
it
like
was,
a clone, you know, it was a little type,
And then, but thankfully he was wearing a big leather trench coat, which offset the whole ensemble. But you're talking about Anaheim, which is a fairly conservative place. And you're talking about the Rolling Stones.
Right.
Anaheim, and it was 50,000 people out there.
Oh,
I think 55,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was a blazing hot day. And Prince was unknown. Prince was unknown at that time. So, you know, it was just an awful lot, I think, for that audience to take in. You know, all the shirtless beer guzzlers, you know. It's just a little bit much for them in broad daylight. You know, there's no lights to help. It wasn't night yet. Of course, the Stones performance went from sundown way into the night.
Oh, so it was not, it was outside. The performance was outside. Okay.
55,000 in a stadium.
Yeah, in a stadium. Okay. All right. I was thinking arena, but yeah, of course. Wow. That's, I mean, obviously he came back, and Leroy talked about how it took Mick calling him to get him to come back, and a few other people. But I mean, just, you think about that now, I mean, how he's one of the biggest megastars literally in the world, even today after his passing, you know, and how that started. I mean, I guess to anyone out there, it gives you hope.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about getting a million no's from interviews and no's from all these different places. And then all of a sudden you finally get the yes. I mean, you get booed off stage by 55,000 people and you come back and you are Prince, the megastar. I mean, that's a pretty inspiring story.
Well, you got to think about it in terms of the bravery that it takes to do that. I mean, you know, who would be possessed with the thought that that's a great idea to go out on an 80 degree day in the middle of conservative Anaheim in a stadium of 55,000 people in a leather thong? I mean, it is really brave, and his whole career was brave, and that's incredible. We need artists that are brave that way.
But I will say, I mean, when it's a super hot day and you're outside, he was wearing the most practical thing, a thong.
You know, I was
going
to wear that too, but I elected to add pants.
Okay, we'll leave that there. So the Purple Rain, the phenomena of Purple Rain, Leroy talks about how that was really the transition. You know, Prince was growing and growing and growing in popularity, and then boom, when Purple Rain hit, it was just through the stratosphere, I think was actually Leroy's words, and that they would move in to a city and they'd be sold out for 2 weeks. I mean, just an insane popularity, you know, for this song. And then I think that probably created even more appreciation for all of his music at that point. But that was, I don't know if Leroy called it the beginning of the end, but that was really the turning point for him. I mean, how do you see that?
Well, I mean, you know, Prince, you know, booked himself so solid and so busy that what human could actually pull all that off?
Right.
He was doing that and then going out, as you know, like as you were just talking about, and doing after show party shows, you know, at some little unannounced club, whether it's the House of Blues or City Winery or something, some small venue. You know, and so he would be going, you know, basically from afternoon until the next morning at 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, there must have been some part of him that knew that he couldn't do that forever. You know, he's a human being.
Mm-hmm. No, I know.
I think.
Yet to be determined.
Yeah.
But the Purple Rain, you know, particularly, I have to share a really quick story. I was the, I ran the events department for Super Bowl 49, and we booked Darius Rucker for one of our biggest events the week of Super Bowl. And a lot of people that knew that I had booked Darius Rucker for this event knew that he was playing Purple Rain on his tours. And they were really excited. I had a number of people say how excited they were, clearly for Darius's music, because he's an amazing musician and vocalist. But people were super excited to see him perform Purple Rain. And I go backstage and I'm looking at the set list. I'm with Darius and his manager, and I see that Purple Rain is not on there. And I said, well, you know, where's Purple Rain? Like, knowing all these conversations. And Darius said, well, you know, I've been performing it for the past, I think, couple tours. And I just thought, you know, I'd change it up. This is kind of the end, like the end of the road for this tour. And I said very respectfully, not tonight, you won't. We're going to need you to play that song.
That was respectful?
That was respectful, okay. Yes. It just kind of came out. And of course, everybody got a big chuckle. But I said, no, please, people are expecting that song. Please play that song. So he said, okay, well, I'll think about it. You know, I really wanted to change it up, whatever. And so we're backstage and he's at the end of the set and he looks over at me and he's like, and by special request, and I just booked it to front of house. I'm like, I've got to see this from the front of house side. Yeah. And he plays Purple Rain and literally the place just erupted. Mm. I mean, just absolutely went insane. Not a single person still sitting. I mean, just the songs that Prince wrote. Mm-hmm. And it just, it's truly remarkable. I mean, the man had so many talent in so many areas and left us, as you've said, such a canon of music before. I mean, thank God we had him even for a short time.
Yeah, yeah. And that story points out, you know, points to the power of song, you know.
Exactly.
And it's a fairly simple song, but it's just so soulful and heartfelt. Etta James actually had a great version of Purple
Rain. Did she?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Just, oh, I wish
I'd remembered that.
That,
yeah.
Speaking of Etta, Leroy talks about how he did have that final meeting with Prince at the Hall of Fame when he was playing the guitar solo of My Guitar Gently Weeps. And he and Leroy had personally hadn't had a falling out, but he hadn't been touring with Prince for a while because of a bunch of stuff that's in the interview. And they had that one final moment, just the two of them in the ballroom backstage, it was amazing that they got that, because Prince did die shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. It just reminded me about how close you are with Etta. Do you remember your last moments with her before she died, or when that happened?
Well, we had been recording for years after I stopped touring with her in 89, I think was my last sort of touring with her. So 15 years from the beginning to the end of touring, but we continued to work together and studio projects. I would play on an album of hers and she, you know, kindly guest vocal on a song of mine called Soft Machine on my first solo album. Anyway, so I'd come out to her ranch out there in Riverside. She had this beautiful sprawling horse property out there. And she had her, you know, couple of sports cars. She loved sports cars. And she had a big RV, you know, one of those sort of massive like tour bus RVs.
She doesn't strike me as a sports car type. That's cute.
It's so cute. Yeah, she loved my MG, because when I first met her, I had a little MG. And so she got way into sports cars. Yeah, adorable. Anyway, so time had passed, and now I had heard that she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I'm going to make a trip out there and be with her, and prepared myself for the idea that she might not be the Etta that I remembered, you know. And she was in her bedroom and laying in bed, and she was a little bit out there and a little bit out of it. And kind of repeating herself a little bit. And then I just came up beside her and got her attention and caught her gaze. And then she locked into my gaze. And then I said, Etta, it's Brian. And she reached out and took my hand. And she said, Brian.
Aww.
Brian, don't leave.
Aww.
And she grabbed onto my hand like really tightly. And I just stayed with her for the longest time, you know, hanging out and just, you know, soaking up some Etta James. Yeah.
So that was the last time you saw her, and she remembered you. And,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Took a little while, but yeah, we did then connected. I was determined to connect with her.
Right.
And and I may not have been able to, but I was glad that I did.
Because how many years were you two together touring?
Of 15 years.
Wow.
And then, you know, another whatever, 20 after that of recording and friendship, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, and you do develop those sorts of friendships, and Leroy talks about a lot of Prince offstage and how partially you what you saw is what you got all the time. I mean, Prince was always Prince, but at the same time, he does talk about how Prince had a really, really sweet side to him, which was really cute, bringing him snacks in the middle of the night as he's redesigning shows and having movie nights at Paisley Park. And so it was just, I thought that was like, I thought that was really cute. I wouldn't have expected that from the perfectionist boot camp Prince.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think it was all in the cause of getting people to work as late as he worked. So, so it might have been very, very sweet. But I asked Leroy, I said, like, what was Prince into? Is he bringing like cauliflower and carrots, you know, or was it more like, you know, Etta James used to call snacks, Brian, go get me some wham whams and zuzus. And I'd run out to the market, you know, we're on tour.
Right.
We'd be at the hotel, you know, holding up in her room, and she wanted some snacks. And
right.
Go down to the corner market and bring back some stuff. And so Leroy gets back to me and said, I'm going to just read his text. He loved junk food. It was usually chips, Doritos. He told me they cure headaches. I think he hadn't eaten. He got a headache, as anyone would. Doritos were his go-to food. So as a result, his headache would go away. Smiley face. Like, I'm not sure that Leroy buys that, but that's what Prince believed.
We're about to put Advil and Tylenol out of business. It's Doritos.
It's
friends.
Doritos, people. You're doing it wrong. The hangover cure, perhaps. And then he writes, bless him. And then he writes, fruit, dips, bread, peanut butter and jelly, cookies, basically anything that had sugar. That was his fuel to keep up. So I guess he needed the same.
I feel like now I know I could be friends with Prince.
Yeah.
Because I can be down with some of those snacks.
I'm just saying, you know, we need at this moment to humanize this deity.
All right. So we could talk about Prince forever, but I do want to wrap this up with a couple of other quick stories here, because Rammstein, because I keep missing it up all the time.
Rammstein,
right?
Is it Rammstein?
Rammstein.
Oh, God. We're going to be in so much trouble. Maybe we should Google this before we go any further. This is embarrassing. We got to know this. Sorry.
Okay, let's get it right. How do you say it?
Rammstein.
Okay. All right. So they are badasses.
Yeah, total.
Completely. Badass. Have you seen one of their shows?
I have not, but I've seen videos of their shows. Ridiculous.
The insane amount of pyro. I mean, how do you come up with that? I mean, it sounds like the band members itself are a huge part of coming up with that. And then Leroy works on the lighting around that. But mm-hmm. I'd be terrified.
It's more like, how do you follow that?
Right.
Like the next tour, more fire? I guess you just need like...
More
next
fire.
Time he's going to be more fire, more pyro. Yeah, more water, fire, you know. And then what they did was the way they'd build on it is the next tour, they'd start with nothing. There'd be nothing on stage.
Oh, wow.
So that when they build to something, it has more impact.
It's like an acoustic intro.
Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Your favorite thing.
Oh, yes. I've got to see one of those shows. I mean, that I'm definitely, I admit I had not heard of them before Leroy's interview. And at this point, I have to see them.
Yeah.
Very cool. So Lady Gaga, also some really great stories. I was actually the vice president of events for Super Bowl 51, the halftime performance that he was talking about. And so I was in Super Bowl Stadium when she flew 90 feet from the air. I mean, that woman is fearless.
Mm. I think that's an important element for the kind of artist that we're talking about. Is courage, bravery. My voice. Courage, bravery.
Jesus.
Courage, bravery, and fearlessness, you know? It's, I can't speak anymore. Courage, bravery, and fearlessness. Very important.
Yes. That would definitely define Lady Gaga, that's yeah. for sure. I mean, what a cool person to work with. I mean, he told some great stories about her. It's just, it's always nice to know, again, who these people are off stage and how amazing they are to actually work with.
Yeah, and that's another artist. I mean, Abe talks about a session he did with her, and her sort of knowledge base of music and her willingness to just keep working at it in the studio. It was really impressive. He was mm-hmm. really impressed by that.
Yeah. Wow. Lots of it seems to be a theme. You know, the biggest artists in the world have the best work ethic.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know? All right. So we're going to wrap it up with the lightning round.
Uh-oh.
All right. So audience question first. I only have one question this week. So if you have questions out there for Brian, please send them in for next week. The question is, I thought this was actually kind of interesting. You've been in the music industry. You've been playing on stage since how old?
Since I was 17, 16, something like
how
that.
How do you hear?
Excuse me?
How does this not affect your hearing?
What?
Exactly.
Oh, that old chestnut. Yeah, right. Well, I do have, I guess, what they would call tinnitus, where I do hear a ringing. And it gets worse if I, say, drink a ton of coffee, don't sleep, and if I hear a lot of loud music. And right now it's fairly sort of subdued, so I'm enjoying that.
Even with all the coffee that you've been drinking?
Excuse me. How do you know about my coffee drinking?
Right. Okay. So my lightning round.
Yes.
All right, so one has to do with music and one has nothing to do with music. Sadly, in this episode, we've talked about some very untimely deaths, Prince being one. We also spoke about Etta James, and we've talked previously about losing musicians way too young. Mm-hmm. Of the musicians that we have lost too soon, which one were you the most shocked by or had the greatest impact on you?
I think Prince was a big shocker for me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just, to me, he still looks like he's 38.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though, you know, he was 50-something
right?
or so, right, when he
passed.
Yeah,
I was shocked when Leroy said that. I was shocked.
It just didn't look like it.
No.
And, I mean, David Bowie, you know, I just wasn't prepared for him to be gone. Tom Petty was not prepared for him to be gone. And they aren't older guys. We just weren't made aware of the nature of their health, you know, that they were in ill health or anything like that. So, I mean, those are just, yeah, I mean, all of them, man. I want all of them to be around always.
I know. I got to say, I think Tom, it was between Tom Petty and Prince for me.
Yeah.
Absolutely devastated on both of those, man.
Adore them.
Oh, God. So you get to do, this is my next question. Are you ready?
I'm getting ready.
Okay. You get to do life over. You have the opportunity to start life over in a different era. Which era do you choose?
You know what? That's wild. I don't think that I would choose a different one.
Really?
I like where we are. I like that I was born straight in the middle of the 1950s. I know I'm old. 1955. I mean, so I was there when, that's when rock and roll started, basically.
Right,
54, 55, 56. That's the, you know, that was the big boom. The big bang, I should say.
Yeah.
That was the big bang right there, you know. And as a result, I got to be influenced and be around the energy that surrounded this new thing called rock and roll. So I'm super happy with that. And then I got to see the 60s as a youngster, you know, preteen youngster, you know, and that's all really valuable. I saw and learned so much. Yeah.
I'm surprised with all the classic cars that you love.
Well, my favorite classic cars are all from the 50s and 60s.
True.
And that's, you know, I am kind of a hobbyist. But I'm a bit of a hobbyist, but my focus has been on the cars that I remember as a child. I guess that's fairly typical for collectors. They are most influenced by the ones they remember when they were little kids.
Right, right. So you did it right, is what you're saying.
I did it right for me.
I love it. All right, that's where we're going to wrap up next week. Well, I'm not going to tell anyone what's coming next week, but you're going to be really excited. We'll see you later, Brian.
Ooh, okay. Sounds good. Okay. Bye, Mandy.
Bye. Thank you for listening. On Tour and The After Show are productions of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. This show is produced by me, Mandy Wimmer, with executive producer Noel Brown. For more information about On Tour, visit our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. For behind-the-scenes photos from these interviews or to submit questions for the after show, visit our social media at On Tour Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For more shows from iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.